we've reached a tipping point. There's approximately 70% of all theaters in the United States that have now converted over to digital. There's no more incentive for the film companies to produce in 35mm, so they're starting the phase-out plan now.
And where are you at in terms of fundraising?
We basically managed, with all the fundraising we've done this year and with the loan that we've been able to get, we're about $10,000 right now from our goal of being able to purchase the equipment that we need. We've done tons and tons of research. We've had over 6 companies come out, give us quotes on the different projectors that we need for our theater. Because of how far we are from our screen and how big the screen is, we have to have a specialized projector that only 2 companies sell. And unfortunately, they're about twice the price of every projector that they sell for the indoor theaters.
Are you somewhat in awe that the community has come out, or the region has come out, and in terms of financial commitments? I mean, based on initial reaction, like, well, we'll never get there.
It really has been kind of overwhelming, and they basically, with all the support we had over last season, convinced us that it was worthwhile trying to get a loan on the equipment to cover the majority of the cost, because we knew that we have a certain limit that we can actually get a loan on, and it was not even close to what we needed to convert the drive-in over. And because of the way we actually run the drive-in theater, we do not own the actual land there, so we do not have any collateral for placing a loan on the business. So what we had to do was actually take a loan out on our other business to be able to afford the projection upgrade. But with all the support that we saw, I convinced us that it was worthwhile to do, so we're basically playing poker right now, putting all of our cards on the table, putting the whole pot in, and hoping for the best.
How far away are you getting support from? You get an idea of, for the first time, maybe of people that, wow, we didn't know that families from, you know, 50 miles out or wherever are coming to see movies?
Well, we've generally known over the last several, well, last 20 years or so, that the majority of the people that come out to the drive-in and support the drive-in are not actually local to the drive-in. They're actually from the Champaign area predominantly, and then a little bit from the Bloomington area over the last 5 years. A lot of the people are kind of in the boat where they tend to take for granted what's there because it's been there so long, where the people that travel, they make the commitment to drive a half hour, 40 minutes to come out to the drive-in. They're the ones that actually want to see it because they actually spend the money. They come out to support the place. But the biggest thing that we've seen is people that used to live in the area, they used to go to college down at the U of I, that now live halfway across the world. Even in Australia and Japan, we've had people sending in donations.
And have you communicated with other drive-ins?
Yeah, we've actually been in talks with a lot of them, and a lot of drive-ins have actually been following our lead because we've been the most successful out of everybody so far for our fundraising efforts. Unfortunately, we're going to find out what the exact numbers are here next week when we actually attend the conference. But it seems like about half of the drive-ins, if not more, by the end of this summer, are not going to be operational in 2014.
And that's because they have to still show 35mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they don't have the money to put into this for the thing. I mean, there's a lot of drive-ins out there that do much worse financially than our theater does, and they're running it basically like a hobby, and they can't afford to put that much money into a hobby.
It seems like with the $100,000 or wherever you're at, you have a pretty positive attitude and you're determined to see this through.
We don't know when we're going to be able to reopen. We have our eyes set on a date. We also know a day that we have to place the order for the equipment by, which is basically right after the Valentine's Day next month, February 14th. We know if we can place it by then with the deposit that we have down, we would be able to get the equipment installed and be able to open our doors in the end of March, in the last weekend of March. If we can't make the goal by then we know that we're probably going to have to push back our opening date. But as long as we get open sometime in May, we'll be perfectly happy. And we've actually had just recently a couple of local businesses that have gone through and said, hey, we're behind you. We've got little donation jars all over the Gibson City community where people have been donating change basically all winter. So there's a few $100 coming in from there. And one local business is just going to start this week a special advertising campaign where every time you get your oil changed at a local automotive place, they'll donate $25 to our fund.
That's Jeff Bossert talking with Ben Haroon, general manager of the Harvest Moon Drive-In in Gibson City. Haroon says 7 drive-in theaters remain in Illinois. That number may fall to 4 if they don't make the digital upgrade in 2013. The full interview with Haroon is on our website, wyll.illinois.edu. Well, drive-in movies may be a great way to see a film, but another way, especially for bad ones, is to invite some friends over, get a few drinks, and riff. Movie riffing became popular recently in part because of the show Mystery Science Theater 3000, a cable program that ran from 1988 to 1999. In the show, a spaceman and his robot friends were forced to watch bad movies, and to pass the time, they'd make their own snarky commentary over top. Here's a clip from their famous theme song. The show struck a chord with the generation and was the most popular program on Comedy Central in the early days that it ran. Several former cast members of the show are now part of something called Riff Tracks, a company that sells their riffs online as MP3s. They also do live movie theater events, and tonight their riff of Plan 9 from Outer Space is being beamed into movie theaters across the country, including two here in Champaign County. I spoke with Bill Corbett about the big influence of the show, Mystery Science Theater.
There's a lot of people who have kind of presented the idea to me that Twitter is like a 24/7 Mystery Science Theater episode, and to some degree that is correct. It's a mass participation riffing of events like the Oscars, the Super Bowls, or whatever. And I have I think that's fine. I think that's fun. Maybe every now and then I wonder, does it dilute what we do? Does it make it a little bit less special, for lack of a better word? And I don't really know about that. I mean, we write ours pretty meticulously. We've never denied that we write, you know, we kind of write all our riffs pretty, I don't know, I'm coming up with the word meticulously again, but basically we plot it out pretty heavily in advance, and, you know, we watch the movie with a time code and we have a joke for it. So it is a written thing that we make sound like we're coming up with it casually, and that's hopefully because we can act it. We've learned to act it well at this point. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question except to say that I really have no problem with people doing, you know, any version of this. It's hard to be good at it consistently. It's hard not to sound like you're just sniping and sarcastic. And, you know, and even we fall into that trap even after all these years. Every now and then, I read a script we've written, or I feel it in the middle of performing it. I just feel like, feels a little too bitter or too one note. And we have to change up the point of view a little bit to make it work. I just mostly feel lucky that people want to hear us do it after all these decades, you know, these middle-aged guys, kind of talking about pop culture.
I was going to say, you bring up Twitter and kind of the fine distinction between riffing and, you know, not riffing well, which I think not riffing well is basically hate watching, right? Which has been like such a big, you know, trend that's happened recently. What's kind of the fine difference between the two things?
You know, I think it's a matter of degrees, and I think when we've been off our game or at our worst, and you know, we've acknowledged that we've had some better moments than others in our career. When we just feel like we've gotten into bad habits, it approaches that, you know, other pole of maybe hate riffing or not very funny riffing, and we look at each other every now and then and just say, you know, we're really in this to be funny. We're not in it to propose that this material is utter garbage, although that is sometimes part of it, admittedly. But we have in the last couple of years done a couple of movies that we've liked, and pointedly so. We did a Riff Tracks challenge of the movie Casablanca, because something we and everybody else acknowledges is a masterpiece of cinema and, you know, a classic. And we thought we might be able to get in there and make it more of a celebrity roast kind of the movie rather than this really sucks over and over again. I mean, it forces you to be a little more on your toes and clever and almost tell an alternate narrative, you know, weaving through that, through the whole experience. And we've done Jaws, which we're all fans of, you know, dated as it might be here and there now. It's really a great movie. And the Indiana Jones series and Lord of the Rings, we have respect for some of the stuff we've riffed.
That's Bill Corbett. Riff Tracks are the Riff Tracks live riff of Plan 9 from Outer Space is being beamed into movie theaters across the country, including a couple here in Illinois tonight. To hear the full interview, go to wyll.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 31st of January, 2013. It's the birthday of Thomas Merton, born in Prades, France in 1915, wrote his master's thesis on William Blake, converted to Christianity, entered a Trappist abbey in Kentucky where he lived for most of his life. In his diary from the time, Thomas Merton wrote, "Going to the Trappists is exciting. I return to the idea again and again. Give up everything. Give up everything." His autobiography was a bestseller in 1948, Seven Story Mountain. It's the birthday of John O'Hara, born in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, 1905, one of the most popular serious writers of his lifetime, author of Appointment in Samara, A Rage to Live. Most critics consider his best work to be his short stories. He published more than 300 of them in the New Yorker magazine. And it's the birthday of the musicologist Alan Lomax, born Austin, Texas, 1915, son of the musicologist John Lomax. John Lomax, who had collected cowboy songs. Alan Lomax dropped out of Harvard to accompany his dad on one of his folk song collecting missions. They went to the Louisiana State Penitentiary, where they met Hoodie William Leadbetter, better known as Leadbelly. Lomax wrote, "I'll never forget, he approached us all the way from the building where he worked with his big 12-string guitar in his hand. He sat down in front of us and proceeded to sing everything that we could think of in this beautiful, clear, trumpet-like voice that he had, with his hands simply flying on the strings." Alan and John Lomax headed up the Library of Congress archive of American folk song, and Alan Lomax went on to record the oral histories of Leadbelly, Woody Guthrie, Jelly Roll Morton, Muddy Waters, and Vera Hall. It's the birthday of Norman Mailer, born Long Branch, New Jersey, 1923, an engineering student at Harvard when he was drafted into the Army, 1944. Served in the Philippines, Japan, then after the war moved to New York City and spent about a year writing a novel about the war